in astronomy, and we would like to bring astronomy to the people. So thank you for coming out. So where do planets come from? It's actually a very long story. In a galaxy far, well, actually in a galaxy very nearby, in our own galaxy, but this happens, we think, all over the place. We stand on the shoulders of giants, and I want to thank all of the scientists who went before me to make all these discoveries possible. By the way, did anybody hear about gravity waves today?
Yeah.
Okay. Today is a day in history. It's not only the third public astronomy lecture of the University of Louisville series, but we have, after many millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars of investigation, corroborated what was predicted by Albert Einstein 100 years ago, that gravity waves exist. And so a gravity wave is a disturbance in a gravitational field that travels at the speed of light. So if I had a black hole here in my hand, pretend it doesn't kill us, and I wave it in front of you, and it's moving, you would feel a ripple of gravity. It's the same way as if you're in a rowboat on a very still lake and an ocean liner passes by. You'll go up and you'll go down. Well, the gravity waves will move you around a little bit. Now, the effects of gravity waves are very small. Basically, the amount of movement that you expect is about 1/1,000,000,000th of an atomic size. So how do you do this? You take a couple of laser beams, you shine them at right angles to each other, and you have a couple of these setups, and they're attached to very well-measured chunks of metal. And so these laser beams will form what's called an interference pattern. They're light waves. Sometimes the light waves will constructively interfere, and they'll build up on each other. Sometimes they'll cancel out. They'll destructively interfere. The slightest movement of the attachment mechanisms for these lasers will cause a change in the light pattern you see. And we can measure that to very fine precision. And so we've been working for years on this. There's this experiment called LIGO, which I think is something like the Laser Interferometry Gravitational Observatory, something like that. And we found a signal last September, and in the team, which are, the team consists of easily 1,000 people. They looked over it and looked over it and looked over it. They didn't want to say anything until they were pretty sure. Then they announced it today. I invite you to go. You can go to lots of good sites, space.com, BBC website is good, CNN has something on it, Science Digest, Science News, all those things. Space.com is actually a pretty good jumping off point. And so it is literally, this is a Nobel Prize. The only question is, how do they divide it up? Because normally they only give it to 3 people, and really a team of 1,000 people should deserve this. So that's for another science talk. But this one is on planets. So where did we come from? We know from the oldest rocks on the moon, which are older than here. The oldest rocks on the moon are about 4.4 billion years ago. The GYR is giga years, like gigabytes. And so our solar system formed at least 4.4 billion years ago. We don't see these rocks on Earth because Earth's surface has been recycled several times. And so every time the crust is moving around, or we have impacts, we have plate tectonics, plates are sliding around. So the Earth's crust has been recycled for the most part. The moon hasn't been doing a whole lot, it's just there. So we can find older rocks on the moon, and meteorites are older too. So the solar system formed about 4.6 billion years ago, we think. It all started out from a giant cloud of gas. And here's one, it's one of the best known ones, the Orion Nebula. It's gas and dust. That's what's in space. Lots of gas and dust. Where does gas and dust come from? Well, stars blow up, they put gas into the interstellar medium, and also stars actually produce dust. They're like old cars with the carbon black coming out of the exhaust. The old stars will make carbon. And gas was one of the leftovers of the Big Bang with hydrogen and helium. Then stars made more and more and more of these heavy elements through their nuclear reactions. And that'll be the topic of next month's talk by Dr. Jim LaRoche. So anyway, there are these clouds of gas and dust floating around all over our galaxy, in all galaxies. So the Orion Nebula is one of them. Some of them are particularly dense and very cold. Space is a very cold place. We're talking about 10 Kelvin, 10 degrees above absolute zero, for these very dense, cold parts of the interstellar medium. And so it's so cold, actually, you have molecules floating around. Molecules of hydrogen, carbon monoxide, let's see what else would be pretty common, hydrocarbons, ethanol is out there, glycine, maybe an amino acid or two. Now, the interstellar medium is not a quiet place. There's always something going on. So you might have a star passing by, and that can tidally disrupt a cloud of gas and cause it to collapse. Or you could have a supernova go by and cause a shock wave. A shock wave happens, for example, when any object travels faster than the speed of sound through the medium around it. So an airplane can create a shock wave by going supersonic. And things in space can go supersonic too, because there is a sound speed in this. And if something zings through at a supersonic speed, it'll make a shock wave. Shock waves are hot and they compress. They're like a giant snowplow. So you have these clouds of gas, and they get a little bit compressed by something, whatever. Two clouds of gas can crunch together, and then they will also produce some sort of increase in density. Whatever does it, there are lots of reasons why, it'll start to collapse. And as it collapses, if it has the little tiniest bit of angular momentum, it'll go faster and faster and faster. Your angular momentum is a spin momentum. So if you have a wheel, say you have a tire on a car and you're spinning it around, it wants to keep spinning until you stop it, ideally. And so one principle of angular momentum is unless you have a twisting motion, it'll be constant. But angular momentum depends both on how fast you're going and how your material is distributed. And so I don't want to do this at home. So I want you to watch this instead. Let's see, wait a minute, we should have a, okay, well, all right, you can see the video. I'm going to see if I can get the sound moving because I think there was some sound here. All right. And I am not a Windows person. Where is this? There. There, okay, that should work. All right, so let's keep going here. So you've got this spinning, and it'll spin faster and faster and faster as the cloud starts to collapse from its own gravity. Because it has a preferred axis, then it won't collapse into a point. It'll collapse along one dimension, which is basically along the spin axis, and it won't collapse in the other two directions, and so what you get is a spinning disk. It's like a giant LP or a rotating pancake. In the middle, it'll still be pretty warm. It'll get denser and denser and denser, and anytime you compress something reasonably fast without conducting heat in and out, it'll heat up. When you pump up a bicycle tire, it will heat up. When a gas cloud starts to collapse, the middle part starts to heat up. Uh-oh. Now I think the sound started. Yeah, right? Something's going on here. Okay, wait, there? Oh, there. Okay, sorry. Yeah, all right. Okay. Like I said, I'm not a Windows person, so the resisting the evil empire, unfortunately, will have some setbacks. Yeah. So you have this spinning disk, and the middle part gets hotter and hotter and hotter. That's where your star starts to form. Star formation is another talk, but what goes on in the disk is actually pretty important, too. You've got this spinning disk of material around the star. And it gets clumps in it. It gets clumps, it has dust and it has gas. The dust will stick together, it's sticky dust, and after a while, the clumps of dust will have enough gravity to start gathering material toward them, either other clumps of dust or bits of gas. The dust will come first, because it's hard to hold on to gas. It's moving, the atoms are zinging around pretty fast. And so you'll get these little things called planetesimals. What's a planetesimal? Think of a little asteroid. And they don't have enough gravity to be round. They can be shaped like a brick, a peanut, a blob, you know, some sort of lopsided thing. And when we look, has anybody heard of the ESA Rosetta mission around the comet? Our last bullet lecture last October was partly about that. It's literally shaped like a rubber duck. You have two bodies. We think that there are two bodies that happen to stick together. And so the neck is the transition zone where these two bodies came together. So planetesimals are little things, and they're not really round yet. They get bigger and bigger and bigger. We call them protoplanets when they start to get round and when they are big enough to have their gravity start to attract stuff around them. They're orbiting, the protoplanets are orbiting this thing in the middle that's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. We call it a protostar, which is not yet shining from nuclear fusion, which is the way stars form. And after a while, you get a little baby solar system. Now, stars are very gregarious creatures, and they tend to form in groups. Remember that cloud of gas, the Orion Nebula? That's many light years across. And so a bunch of stars probably are going to be forming in there over time. Our sun formed with a group. Now, the group stays together for a while, and then it disperses. But while it's together, it's forming some bright, hot, short-lived stars, and it'll form some smaller stars as well. And so very often, you'll have some hot star, and its neighbors are still forming, and the hot star is going to have a lot of heat and light, especially very short wavelength, high-energy blue light and ultraviolet light, and it will irradiate its neighbors, and it'll blow out, it'll blow their, there'll be a shell of gas around this disk. You see the disk here, you see the star, you hear, see a protostar, you see a piece of the disk here, and then it'll literally blow it into a teardrop shape like a windsock. And so these hot stars actually have quite an influence on their neighbors because they can basically stop some of the gas from accreting onto the protostar. And we can see this happening. This is a very famous picture from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's called the Pillars of Creation. So this is the Eagle Nebula, and you'll see these dark areas here is dust. It's not that there's nothing here. There's stuff here, but dust blocks light really, really well. Gas, on the other hand, will fluoresce. It's like a giant neon light. But in space, you got more than neon. You have things like sulfur and argon and hydrogen. And so astronomers do, I'll tell you a dirty little secret, we do a lot of color coding. And so this color coding is just to help the eye. And so we do the best that we can. If we know that we have neon light, it'll be reddish, like a neon sign. Hydrogen light's reddish. Some oxygen can be bluish. So somebody applied some artistic license, but this is what you see in regular optical light. This is from the Space Telescope with very, very, very high resolution, super sharp vision. And yeah, there are some bright stars here that you can see. There are some that you can't. If you look at infrared wavelengths, this is the same area. Suddenly, you can see more stars in these dark areas because the infrared light will pass right through the dust. And you can see what's behind them. So these aren't empty areas at all. This is a star formation region, and the star forming areas are right around here and around here and around here. There's some sort of wind. I think that there's some sort of hot star in open that direction that's literally blowing off the dust and gas on the one side. And what you see is there's a little bright rim here, a bright rim here, and a bright rim here. So we can see the star formation happening right now. So what about the planets? Okay, so you have this cloud of gas, and it's collapsing and rotating faster and forms this disk, and then the things form in the disk. You have the planets forming in the disk, and the middle forms a star. There will be a wide size range of bits and pieces. You'll have a few big things and a lot of little things. Countries on Earth, a few big countries, a lot of little countries. Types of animals on Earth, a few big animals, a lot of little animals. A few big planets, a lot of little planets. A few big asteroids, a lot of little asteroids. A few big planets, a lot of little things. And so in our own solar system, we have this, it's called a power law distribution, of a few big things, and then you have asteroids, meteoroids, all this little stuff. Now, as the star is starting to shine and heat up, it's starting its nuclear engine eventually, it's going to get hotter and hotter and hotter. It's going to have more and more light, a lot of high-energy light. It'll evaporate the stuff around it, just like if you took a hairdryer to a block of dry ice, and it'll just blow it away. If there's dust in the solar system, it can be blown away by light pressure, if it's small. Or if it's big, there's an interesting effect that'll happen. You have a dust particle going dump, da-dump, 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 da-dump in orbit, and a photon will come by. And photons are very interesting, light, because light has two different personalities. Light can act like a particle, or light can act like a wave. And it does both at the same time, actually. So in this case, we can treat it like a particle. So you have your dust particle coming along, and your photon coming along, and they go bang. And what happens is the dust particle, the photon has momentum. Doesn't have any mass, but it has momentum. The dust particle will be slowed down, and it'll slowly spiral into the star. It's called the Poynting-Robertson effect. So the light stuff gets blown out by light pressure, and light pressure, you can see light pressure if you go to a science store and you get one of those little light bulb type things with the paddles, and you shine the light on it, and one side of the paddle is black, and the other side of the paddle is white or silver. You put it in the light, and it'll start to spin. That's light pressure. The photons literally are like little raindrops, and they will also help to clean out the dust particles and bigger dust particles and even baseball-sized things in the solar system. So the solar system gets cleared out in a few million years, and that's it. So here's a little video, which I hope works. Hope all the attachments work. Will it? Come on. All right. Let's do it this way. Works on the Mac. Let's see here, where are the animations? Here it is. This should work. I'll force it. There you go. So you can see the dust cloud, it has very little bit of rotation, it'll eventually get smaller and smaller and smaller. It'll form a disk. In the disk there'll be little things condensing. Eventually, those are the planets. Materials falling in toward the star, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. Eventually the nuclear engine starts, it'll start nuclear fusion, shine very, very brightly, and it will literally evaporate away the rest of that disk, and only the big solid things are going to stay. There's a little bit of gas in our solar system, but not a whole lot. What's left is the remnants. And if you think, well, wait a minute, the dust gets blown away or it falls into the sun, why do we have so much dust in our... We do have dust. We have interplanetary dust. Every time you have a smash-up in the solar system, it makes a lot of little pieces. And so that dust is continuously replaced. Okay, so back to this. We have undergone a revolution to be able to see all this. We've theorized about this a lot, and for all the history that we've had up until recently, we had one example of a solar system. We thought, okay, this is our solar system. Are we alone? Are there any other solar systems around? We don't know. Are we special? Are there a lot of others? We don't know. And all we have, we have some terrestrial planets. We have some giant planets. We have a few odds and ends. We have Pluto, which keeps falling in different categories, asteroids. How does this get to be? Well, in 1990, the Space Telescope was launched, and that opened our eyes to a new universe. I showed you a Space Telescope picture. In the 1980s, infrared astronomy came of age. Military technology was declassified, and it helped us a lot to see things. What infrared light is good for two very big things. Number one, infrared light will pass through dust. So that which used to be hidden behind dust, we could see now. And the other thing that's important about infrared light is it tells us about the cold universe. Space is very cold. Khan said space is very cold in Star Trek II, and he was right. Space is very, very cold. So if you want to see cold things, you've got to look with long wavelength light, infrared light, microwave light. And so looking at infrared light and microwaves, the third thing that's coming in, infrared astronomy started in the 80s. There's a satellite called the Infrared Astronomy Satellite in 1985, which revolutionized astronomy. And we have other things like Spitzer and Herschel and so on. And we're also looking at microwaves, and there's a giant telescope in Chile called the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA, which is kind of a play on words, Spanish word for soul. And so these helped us a lot. And I want to stress that in astronomy, we cover a huge amount of wavelengths. When any object will give off a lot of different wavelengths. If you look at me or you look at a friend of yours, you'll see mostly visible light. We give off infrared light. Our eyes can't see it. Objects can give off X-rays, gamma rays and X-rays, short wavelengths, ultraviolet light. This is very hot stuff. This is generally cold stuff. You can get radio waves from a number of different things. You can have atoms having their electrons flip up and down, for example. That'll make radio waves. You can have molecules that are vibrating very slowly. That'll make radio waves. Your eyes can see only a little bit of the available wavelengths. We cannot see ultraviolet X-rays or gamma rays. They don't even pass through our atmosphere. We can see some infrared light. We can't see others. It depends on what wavelengths you're talking about. We can see good number of radio waves. And actually, for the infrared light, looking from the ground is like looking through a dirty stained glass window. You can see some colors, but you can't see others. So we have a limited view. And if you want to really see well at anything other than optical light, and even optical light, you want to go above the atmosphere because our atmosphere is turbulent, you basically want to get above our atmosphere as much as possible. Our infrared sky glows. Not all the wavelengths come to the ground. And the ultraviolet sky and X-ray sky as well is hidden. So we need to go into space. So this is one of our workhorses. This is a $1 billion telescope, another $1 billion for all the servicing missions to keep it going. How many of you, this was launched in 1990 and it's still going, it's 26 years. How many of you have a 26-year-old car? Okay. This was serviced 5 times. How many times was yours serviced? Okay, see? Now do you appreciate what an engineering marvel this is? This was serviced 5 times, and that's it. It's battery change, lube, job, shocks. All the electronics. It's on a second or third generation solar panels. They replace batteries, data recorders, you name it. And space is really mean. You have all of these high-speed charged particles zinging back and forth, and they will fry electronics like you wouldn't believe. So this is a very hardy instrument. And yes, they made a mistake on the mirror, and it only cost $500 million to fix it. But the joke is that the instrument to fix it was extra optics. It was like a pair of spectacles. It was called COSTAR, for coaxial optical something. But COSTAR in Spanish means to cost. And it did. It was a costly mistake. So that's a space telescope. In infrared astronomy, there are a couple of satellites also that have revolutionized the field. One is called Spitzer, and it's still working. Now, infrared astronomy is very tough because you have to have a cold camera, because anything that's warm will radiate infrared light. So you can't have a camera which is warm, which is observing infrared light. So this thing was cooled down with liquid helium, and the liquid helium lasted for a while, but it boiled off. It was designed that way. So ever since about 2007 or so, it's been observing only a couple of the shortest wavelengths that it can still observe without the coolant. The Herschel Space Telescope observes even longer wavelength light. It's a little bit bigger. This is bigger than the Hubble Space Telescope, by the way. And it lasted for 4 years until its liquid helium ran out. And it can't observe without liquid helium, so it's done. So the James Webb Space Telescope, which is supposed to launch in 2018, is also an infrared telescope. It has a passive cooling system. It doesn't have helium, so it should be able to last for a long time, we hope. Knock on whatever you can. And in microwaves, this is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It's still being built by Japan, U.S., and Europe. It's sited in Chile. I think Canada's a partner. And this is a $1 billion telescope. Hubble's $2 billion. Spitzer and Herschel are easily together. They're probably about $1 billion. And then this is $1 billion. So astronomy is a very, very, very expensive sport. And it has to be done with basically big government resources to do this sort of stuff in general. Unfortunately, governments don't have a whole lot of money, which is why we're doing that, the Fund for Astronomy Research. So I told you a little bit. I want to give you a few more details about the formation of these planetary systems. You should start out with a cloud of gas, and it starts to collapse and rotate. Now, as it gets denser, then you have it, as long as it's cold, you have a chance for molecules to form. When you get in your protoplanetary disk, the outer parts of the protoplanetary disk have molecules in them. And then as you have these condensations form, you have a chance for more and more complex molecules until you can get somehow to life. And by the way, we do not know how to connect this step. I should put a little question mark here. We're working on it, but that's for astrobiology, which is yet another astronomy talk. We'll have an astrobiology talk next year sometime, I think. So we have these protoplanetary disks. After a while, when the gas evaporates away, they're full of debris. We call them debris disks. And we've known about these for a long time, since the 1980s, because this infrared astronomy satellite from the 1980s found stars that we thought were just plain old normal stars like Vega. Vega's up there, summer triangle, hotter than the sun, about twice as hot as the sun. And it had this big cloud of dust around. We thought, what the heck is that? Turns out that it has a disk around it. And so we see these disks, and they're all over the place. We can find them around high-mass stars. We call them Herbig AE for emission, BE stars. A and B stars are hotter than the sun. Or T-Tauri stars, those are low-mass stars. And these are all young objects. We call them young stellar objects. We see disks all over the place. So how do we see them? Infrared light. This particular picture is from the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It's partially built, but it's getting data already. And in Taurus, anytime you see a couple of letters, it's a variable star, it's a young star. So this is Taurus and Orion, or this star-forming region. We can see this, and we see a disk, and it has grooves cut in it. And we think these may be baby planets. And you need really, really, really super sharp vision. So the Hubble is important. These infrared telescopes are important. How big are they? 1,000 astronomical units. One astronomical unit is the distance to the from Earth to Sun. And 40 AU is from Pluto to the Sun. So this is a couple thousand, so this is 25 times bigger than the distance from the Sun to Pluto. So these can be quite big. And when we look at a whole bunch of young stars, how many of them have disks? We can measure the ages of stars by looking at a couple of spectral lines in them. They destroy lithium at a known rate, for example. So the younger the star, the more likely it is to have a disk. So a whole lot of them have disks in their first few million years, and then the disks tend to go away after they're about 10 or 20 million years old. So the disk is a very short-lived phenomenon. We're talking about 4.4, 4.6 billion years for our Earth's history. The Sun had a disk around it for maybe 20, 25 million years. And we see a whole bunch of these things. So here's a schematic. You've got a star in the middle. You've got a disk, but it's not actually a flat pancake. It's more like a, how can I do this? How can I think of this? It's flared. Its edges are wider than its middle because the edges get shielded. The light can't pass through the disk, so this part gets cold. And if it's cold, the gas and the dust are going to stick around. What's more, there are a couple of jets here. What happens? The material is spiraling into the star. And the pressure builds up. If you've ever tried to pour something down a drain, you know that the drain will only take a certain amount of water before it backs up. If you tried to dump a whole bucket of water very quickly down your kitchen sink, it would splash back. That's basically what's happening here with the star. Because the material gets hotter and hotter and hotter as it spirals in, it gets compressed. The pressure goes up, and it'll squirt some of the gas out the path of least resistance, which is the poles, which makes jets. And we see them. We see them right here. These are pictures from Space Telescope in infrared light. This is the near-infrared camera multi-object spectrograph. This is Hubble sees a very little bit of infrared light, so we can see through some of the dust. And what you see is sometimes a dark lane, that's a dust lane, and then you see material coming out that can be jets. So there's sort of a disk. This is a hamburger type thing that has a couple of jets. You see something here that's some sort of disk and then a jet. And we see these all over the place. So we can see star formation and planet formation happening. And star and planet formation go like that. You don't form planets without stars. Planets can get ejected from star systems, but they don't form alone, we don't think. So if you look in detail, it's one of these disks. It flares sort of like a trumpet. The closer you are to the star, the hotter it is. And that makes a difference as to what is there. So what you have very close in, anything that's going to be solid is going to be high melting point stuff. Chunks of iron, nickel. You go out a little bit more, you can have things like sand, silicate sand. And then you go farther out, and then you get ice, and you get, how does a snowflake form? You have a little particle of dust, and then you have the water form around it, it's frozen. Well, it's the same sort of thing out here. So you have this gradation of things, from heavy, high melting point stuff, to light, low melting point stuff out here. And when you take a look at your disk, you even have something called the snow line. This is where water can be solid beyond this point. It's got far enough away from the star. And if we look in our own solar system, the icy bodies are out basically the snow lines around the outer edge of the asteroid belt. Ceres, which is an asteroid, appears to have ice or have had ice in it. So we think that it may have come from farther out and somehow migrated into the asteroid belt. So you have, again, this picture in your mind that the closer you are to the star, the higher the melting point stuff you have. And that's why our Earth is made out of iron and nickel in the core and sand, basically. Yes, Kahn was right. We live on a sand heap. So you have sand, and then you have a very thin layer of water and atmosphere and stuff like that. So if you want to observe these protoplanetary disks, you have to realize that if you want to observe water, you look with millimeter and microwave telescopes. If you want to look at some of the sort of the dusty stuff, as it gets warmer and warmer, it'll be more middle infrared, near infrared. And then as you go closer and closer and closer to the star, you're going to look at shorter and shorter wavelengths of light to probe in here, because hotter stuff gives off shorter wavelength light. That includes all sorts of atomic transitions from hydrogen and things like that. So to take apart these protoplanetary disks, that's why we need a bunch of different instruments, because the temperatures are different based on whether you're here, where it's warm, medium, or very cold. We can see disks changing over time, actually. And you might think about this. What happens is the star is turning on. When the star hasn't turned on very much yet, you'll have gas going all the way in toward the star. And at the same time, the little dust clumps are going to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're going to start to attract gas to them. So as you go along in time, gravity, the disk itself has gravity, and things are going to want to crunch down into a plane. And you have bigger and bigger bodies, and you're starting to develop a gap here. And as the star is getting hotter and hotter and hotter, it's going to get rid of the gas here. You've left with more large bodies, and you still have some gas out here. This is called a transitional disk. It has a hole in it. And then at the end, all the gas is gone. We can see each of these stages. One of the ways we look is with something called a coronagraph. It is something to block out the light from the central star. You can have a contrast of a million or a billion times between star and a faint disk of dust and gas around it. So the way that we look at it, so that we don't, if you're taking a picture of something with a camera, you know that if you have a really bright light and then something faint, you can't get both in the picture. You either set your camera for the bright thing or for the faint thing. But if you set it for the faint thing and there's a bright object in there, then you have this giant light thing in there, and it'll wash out all your detail. So what we do is we artificially block out the light. It's like a little artificial eclipse. There's a piece of metal in the camera. Hubble has some, our ground-based telescopes have some, which we put over the bright spot. And I do the same thing when I'm driving, because there are a lot of very bright headlights out there, and I have a small car, so I'm down at the headlight level of trucks. So I've literally put up my hand to block out the light so I can see, and the telescopes do that too, so we can observe the faint disks of dust and gas around them. So we do that. This is with the Keck telescope on the ground. This is with the Hubble, and this is also with the Keck. And so we have pictures of hundreds of different disks around stars. So we can see all of their states of evolution, from the young ones with a lot of gas to the older ones, which basically the gas is gone, but some of the solid stuff is still there. And if you want to look, you can look forever, well, not forever, but for a really long time, at all of the protoplanetary disks that the Hubble has taken, for example. It has a giant archive. And ALMA also is developing an archive. And you can see here the incredible detail that you get with some of these telescopes. The reason ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, takes such good pictures is because we electronically add together the light from a bunch of dishes that are something like 15 or 20 kilometers apart. And it acts like one giant telescope of that size. And in astronomy, bigger is better. You collect more light, and you also have sharper vision. So that's why we're always trying to build bigger telescopes. And universities, in addition to competing in football and basketball, the Caltech telescope team and the MIT telescope team, they're a little better than we are right now. But we hope to level the playing field. Yeah. So anyway, we can see all of this going on. And whenever you see a dark thing in the middle, that's not an artifact and it's not a mistake. We're trying to block out the light from the bright thing so that we can see the faint thing around it. Now, I mentioned those transitional disks. They're lifesavers. They have a hole in the middle. The star is turning on. The gas is going away. And there can be some help, because there might even be things like planets forming in there. Some of them look like horse collars, some of them look like donuts. And if you look at these transitional disks, again, you'll see this slow, gradual change between the solid little particles here, which are warm, and then it gets colder and colder and colder, and you get the little stuff, and you still might have some gas out here, and you have this this line where water condenses. And there's a lot of water in the universe. Hydrogen's very common. Oxygen, carbon, nitrogen are very common. So we keep finding things made from those elements, including amino acids and life. So how do you make the planets themselves? Well, the giant planets have to form fast because the giant planets are made of a lot of gas that comes from this disk. They have to form before the gas goes away. We could take longer, but to form Jupiter and Saturn, once the gas was gone, that was it. They weren't going to grow anymore. So there are two models. One says that in your gas cloud, there are little clumps that form from the gas, and they start to grow. It's called the disk instability model. You have a little unstable point, and it starts to grow. And eventually, after the gas comes together, then it gathers in some rocks by gravity, and then the core forms as well. So here's a little video, which I hope works. Let's see. So you can see there's, you know what? There is this here. Let's see, is this here? Huh, thought there was sound here. All right, let's try it again. All right, you can see these little clumps forming. There are spiral waves, by the way, are a natural consequence of objects circulating in this dusty disk. And so let me go back one more time here. I'll see if I can start it and stop it. All right. So you can see right here, there's an unstable region. There's an unstable region. There's an unstable region. And they'll get bigger and bigger. The gas is going away because the gas is being attracted to these forming planets. And you'll have probably a bunch of bodies. And after a while, the bodies themselves will collide. So this is a computer model. Because actually seeing this happen is tough. In cosmic time, 10 million years is nothing, so it's rare that any one system is going to have this happening. We think we have. That's why we're looking at these disks. Let's go back here. That's why we're looking at these disks like these. That's where we think we see the signature. Oh, no. Not again. All right. Wait a minute. Yeah, all right. Yeah, I know. I appreciate that, too. All right. So there's another way that we think it happens. Not the gas first, but the rocks and the dust. It's called the core accretion model. So you have your cloud of gas and dust, and the dust is sticking together, and it makes little bigger disks of dust and bigger disks of dust, and they attract more dust eventually by gravity, and then you gather the gas on top from there. And so what you have is your planet grows kind of slowly at first, with the core, the rocky core, and then it gets enough gravity eventually to attract a whole bunch of that protosolar nebula, the gas in the disk. So here's a little video here on the other way to form planets. Uh-oh. 3, 2, 1. There. Okay.
Researchers at Southwest Research Institute, SWRI, and Queen's University in Canada have unraveled the mystery of how Jupiter and Saturn likely formed. This discovery, which changes our view of how all planets might have formed, will be published in the August 20th issue of Nature. Ironically,
from last year.
The largest planets in the solar system likely formed first. Jupiter and Saturn, which are mostly hydrogen and helium, presumably accumulated their gases before the solar nebula dispersed. Observations of young star systems show that the gas disks that form planets usually have lifetimes of only 1 to 10 million years, which means the gas giant planets in our solar system probably formed within this time frame. In contrast, the Earth probably took at least 30 million years to form, and may have taken as long as 100 million years. So how could Jupiter and Saturn have formed so quickly? The most widely accepted theory for gas giant formation is the so-called core accretion model. In this model, a planet-sized core of ice and rock forms first, then an inflow of interstellar gas and dust attaches itself to the growing planet. However, this model has an Achilles heel. Specifically, the very first step in the process to accumulate a massive atmosphere requires a solid core roughly 10 times the mass of Earth. Yet these large objects, which are akin to Uranus and Neptune, had to have formed in only a few million years. In the standard model of planet formation, rocky cores grow as similarly sized objects accumulate and assimilate through a process called accretion. Rocks incorporate other rocks, creating mountains, then mountains merge with other mountains, leading to city-sized objects, and so on. However, this model is unable to produce planetary cores large enough in a short enough period of time to explain Saturn and Jupiter.
All right, this time I'm going to turn it off so we don't get other sound effects. Now, as planets are forming, I mentioned the disk has, there's a relationship in the disk between how far are you from the star and what's there. Goes the same for planets. Where the planet, it's all in the neighborhood. Location, location, location. So the closer you are to the star, the heavier the stuff is that you are made from. And a combination of how hot it is, which says how, which dictates how fast atoms are zinging around, say in a gas, and how big your planet is will determine what you can keep. So Titan, which is a little bit bigger than Mercury, but out at the orbit of Saturn, so it gets 1% of the light that Earth does, has an atmosphere which is 10 times denser than ours. It's made out of nitrogen. 10 times denser, and it's little Titan. If you were to move Titan over here to close on where to our distance from the Sun, it wouldn't have nearly the atmosphere because its gravity isn't strong enough to hold that much. It'll hold certain things, it won't hold everything. So it's the size and the temperature. Now Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune are big and they're cold, so they can hold on to a lot of stuff. And their satellites have atmospheres because they're cold. Titan has an atmosphere, Triton has an atmosphere. Mercury's very close to the Sun. It doesn't have much of an atmosphere because it's so hot. Venus and Earth have enough gravity. So it's all about the temperature. So what you get is close in to the Sun. You get things like iron and nickel have the highest melting points of the common elements around. And so that's going to be what's making the most massive part of the planet close to the Sun. As you go farther and farther away, methane and ammonia and water, which are hydrogen plus oxygen, hydrogen plus nitrogen, and hydrogen plus carbon, they're very common and they stick around, and actually the molecules form as well. So that's why you have what's here. Now what you have in the asteroid belt, which is kind of an oddball, is Jupiter's gravity probably prevented anything from coming together, and moreover, it could have thrown away a lot of material. If you add up all the material in the asteroid belt, it's not really enough to make much of a planet. It's less than the Moon's mass, I think. So there's probably more stuff there at some point. And then the other thing that's important is, I just said the closer you are to the Sun, the heavier the stuff you're made of. Now, on Earth, where we have an iron-nickel core, and then we have silicate sand for our mantle. So where did the water come from? We don't think it was here at the beginning. There might have been some at the beginning, but it probably evaporated off, and we had a lot of collisions that heated up the Earth, and that would have made the water evaporate away. The water probably came after the surface of Earth cooled and may have come in several waves from icy bodies from the outer solar system. And that's really important because we need it for life. And this whole notion of stuff coming from the outer solar system, the inner solar system, is very, very important. So this last thing I wanted to show you is a little doodad from University of Nebraska at Lincoln, which is great in astronomy education. So you can see the closer you are to the Sun, the top part is solid, and the lower part is gas, and the farther away you get from the Sun, the more things become solid. So by the time you get to Mars, for example, you have all sorts, you have metals, you have minerals and stuff like that. By the time you get to Jupiter, water is solid, And then you go farther out, ammonia, methane, and then even argon, neon, nitrogen. On Pluto, nitrogen is solid. That's pretty good. Solid nitrogen, I haven't seen solid nitrogen. It's something like, Pluto's about 40 Kelvin, 40 above absolute zero. So it's all about your location. Well, let's see, I hope this works. Yeah. So planets can move. So revelation, planets move around. If you'd asked this in an astronomy class 30 years ago, they would have laughed at you. Now, people are working on it like crazy. Planets move! Oh no. And if you have a bully in the solar system like Jupiter, it'll throw the other planets around like crazy because it's like a flea dancing with an elephant. Well, the elephant's not going to move very fast, but the flea sure will. And so we think that our solar system's been shuffled around potentially quite a bit. There's something called the Grand Tack model, which is where Jupiter and Saturn moved in and then out.
The current solar system is likely configured differently than the way it was originally formed, a version which did not include Earth. According to a new study, it is believed that Jupiter began to migrate toward the Sun, and its gravitational forces set off a series of planetary collisions and chain reactions that destroyed existing planets in its path. Scientists began investigating this period in an effort to understand why our solar system is configured differently from others where planets orbit in much higher formations.
That's another talk.
Their hosts are. Years ago, the Grand Tack theory was proposed, where Jupiter is thought to have been pulled toward the Sun along with Saturn until their gravitational forces sent them on a reverse path back out their current places. New models hypothesize that the huge planet's movement led to the mass destruction of early inner planets, the fragments of which were likely destroyed by the Sun. From there, a group of planets, Venus, Mercury, Earth, and Mars, formed in a blank space in a second generation, which could explain their relative youth compared to the outer planets.
So watch out, if Jupiter comes in the neighborhood, run. Just get out. Dive for cover. Okay, I'm going to show you a couple of models from a place called Nice, France, where I spent a couple of years. And they don't... Well, maybe they do. They didn't work on my Mac. Maybe they'll work here. Does this work here? No, it's not enabled. Okay. I'll get these things here. Let's see. Top view here. I think it's this one. All right. So this is Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. And you have these small things on the outside the orbit of Uranus. Now, Jupiter is very massive, and you can see over the millions of years that the orbits are changing a little bit. There are resonances. If Jupiter makes two revolutions, Saturn makes one. So they keep lining up and reinforcing a little tug on each other every orbit or so. And many planets and satellite systems have these resonances, 3-2, 4-3, stuff like that. So they periodically line up. And eventually, after a while, the orbits are going to get changed. And it can be very sudden and violent. And if you were to throw a big planet like Neptune out here, then it would scatter the small bodies. Many of them would go out. Some of them would come in. And we have evidence that things came in. Let's see. There's another one here. And what this tells you, this is Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. This is the distance from the Sun. This is the eccentricity of the orbit, how elliptical things are. And you can see that the small things are avoiding the neighborhood where the big bullies are. So if things are here, they have very elliptical orbits. They can come in, and then they can get thrown out again. So they avoid very eccentric orbits, if they can help it. Or if they have eccentric orbits, they're going to be very far away. And eventually what's going to happen, I think around 800 million years or so, and you can see that Saturn is changing its ellipticity a little bit, and this 1-2 resonance, is Saturn goes around once and Jupiter goes around twice, it's continually tugging on each other. They're They're perturbing each other's orbits. And then Neptune and Uranus are affected a little bit, and let's see, somewhere around 800 or 900 million years. Neptune gets thrown out again, and Neptune is big enough to zing these outer solar system objects. Some of them will come in, and some of them will go out. And you can see Saturn as well as being affected. Its orbit is elliptical. It's big enough so that it's more or less staying at the same distance. So we had a lot of stuff going on in our early solar system, which is pretty violent. And the last one here of these Morbidelli models from Alessandro Morbidelli, here's Jupiter, and then this is roughly the orbit of Mars. These red things are planetesimal, or protoplanets, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. They collide with each other. The green things are small things. This is the asteroid belt, and you can't have very eccentric orbits close to Jupiter because they'll go out to Jupiter and then get thrown out. So they have to stay in fairly circular orbits the closer they are to Jupiter. And eventually, some of these things are going to wander around. What's left here? Well, you see, the farther away you are from Jupiter, the bigger you can get. But the closer you get to the Sun, the smaller you get because it's hotter. So Earth is about the sweet spot, we think. But this doesn't include things like Jupiter came in. So this is one of the models of how things work. And by the way, this is only 70 million years so far. We think that Earth formed in 100 million years or less. Not 10, not 20, but 50 to 100, something like that. And what happens eventually with the small stuff will eventually either impact these planets or get thrown out. The stuff that's in the asteroid belt, they basically, if they're here, this is the zone where they can survive. So another revolution, I didn't have a slide for this, but computer simulations allowed us to get a lot of insight about how things work. So to reiterate, we think the giant planets were moving around, and when they moved around, they were throwing around the small stuff, which could have affected us in a number of ways. These are the two things I can't get to work with the activation of the movies. So after these planets are migrating, we had what we call the late heavy bombardment, and I'm getting close to the end, just to give you a heads up here. Earth's worst days, or worst days in the solar system. Must be from Hawaii. Of California. Okay, there are a whole bunch of these, actually. If you want to look up solar system's top 10 catastrophes, they have a bunch of interesting ones. All right. So we can see the scars of these solar system impacts everywhere. Mercury has a giant basin called the Caloris Basin, and Mercury as well acts like a giant core that had its mantle knocked off. It has a giant core. We don't know where it's the only planet we know that the only terrestrial planet that doesn't have much of a mantle. Venus rotates backwards. Why? Well, it could have been an impact. Could have been that its atmosphere has tides that could have slowed it down, too. Our moon, we think, formed from a blow. Now, just recently, there's a news article out which says it was a direct hit rather than a glancing blow. But it was a blow of some sort from some object about the size of Mars. We call it Theia. And where's Theia? Most of it's down there. Probably mixed with our core. Mars has this giant northern basin. There's an asteroid called Vesta that nearly got destroyed. There's a Saturn moon called Mimas. It's called the Death Star. This is the crater. This is the body. If a bigger crater would be made, the moon may well have broken up. And there probably are things that broke up because there are a lot of bits and pieces floating around the solar system now. Uranus is rotating sideways, and so on, and so on, and so on. So we have a lot of evidence of probably big impacts, a lot of them, not just a few. So actually, I'm going to make a cut here and stop here because exoplanets would be another talk, and we want to save some stuff for next time. So I will be happy to stop right here and take your questions. So thank you for your attention. I really appreciate that you came. Yeah, sure, yeah. Yes. What's your question? I'm just taking this just for posterity's sake. Yeah, what's your question? Depends. The giant planets form fast. They had to because there had to be gas in the solar system, in the disk. So the giant planets are about 10 million years. Terrestrial planets probably more like 70 to 100 million. Because the neighborhood where they were got cleared out first, and they were only made of the heavy stuff. So to make a terrestrial planet, you have to have a more infrequent, rare collision of heavy things. There just aren't that many heavy things. There's an awful lot of hydrogen and helium in that proto-solar disk, and there's not that much heavy material, so it took longer. Yeah?
So do gas giants actually have a core, a mantle, anything you can land on?
We don't think there's a solid surface. Probably a giant slush ball is our guess. The only way, well, we have a lot of models. Computer technology and physics really help us a lot to figure out what's going on. So to the best understanding that we have, they're giant slush balls. Jupiter, for example, has various layers. It's like a layer cake. And so there's molecular hydrogen, then there's metallic hydrogen. It may have a core, which is made out of rock, but the temperature of Earth's core is about 5,000 Kelvin. So it's liquid rock. You think magma is hot coming out of a volcano, wait till you get to the core of the Earth. Then it's heated up by decay of radioactive elements. Jupiter's core, because of the pressure, we can figure out the pressure and temperature that has to be inside to support it against its gravity. We know the gravity, and then we know the mass from the moon zinging around. So we know how hot Jupiter has to be in the middle to hold up all that mass. And it's going to be somewhere around 14,000 to 35,000 Kelvin. So this middle of the moon, the middle of Jupiter is hotter than the surface of the sun. The middle of Earth is about the same as the surface of the sun. So it's really hot. So do you call that solid? It's liquid rock and metal, and it's very dense. So probably not solid, sorry to say. So some of those science fiction movies, uh-uh. But there's still a lot of good science fiction. Martian's good. Yeah?
Venus.
Well, its orbit's the same as everything, but it's rotating backwards.
Right.
That's weird.
And it's got essentially a fresh surface.
Yeah, that's right, 500 million years old.
It's very hot,
yeah.
Very dense atmosphere. What is going on there?
Well, we think with Venus what happened, it's similar mass to the Earth, but it's a little bit hotter. It also doesn't have much of a magnetic field. And it turns out Mercury has a weak magnetic field, Earth has a strong one, Venus doesn't have much of one, and Mars doesn't have much of one. It's like little frozen bits here and there, but no global magnetic field. The magnetic field of Earth will channel the charged particles coming from the sun around the magnetic field lines, and they'll bounce around, they're called magnetic mirror points. It'll bounce around in these donut-shaped regions called the Van Allen belts for a while, and eventually impact the atmosphere where the magnetic lines of force hit the atmosphere near the poles, which makes the aurora. With Venus, that doesn't happen. So the charged particles coming from the sun is basically boiling off its atmosphere. And so the charged particles coming from the sun will hit the atmosphere of Venus and of Mars, break apart molecules. Any hydrogen that was there, like in water, will leave because it's a very light atom and it's moving around fast because of the temperature there. So the hydrogen will go. What's left? Well, oxygen will go. Oxygen will bind with whatever. There's carbon. Venus probably has as much carbon as Earth does, but our carbon was absorbed by liquid water. The oceans will absorb carbon dioxide, and then little one-celled plants will take in carbon dioxide, make cell walls, die, sink to the bottom of the ocean, make rock, calcium carbonate. That's the shells. That's chalk. Make the rock, and then the plate tectonics here will shove that under the continent. So the carbon here is buried. It'll come out through volcanoes, but there's a cycle of burying the carbon. On Venus, there's no plate tectonics. It's all one plate. No oceans, because it's a little bit warmer. And what we think happened was called the runaway greenhouse effect. So it was warm enough for the water to evaporate. So the water couldn't absorb the carbon dioxide. And what's worse, water is a greenhouse gas. Don't tell the EPA. Now, water is it's important. The greenhouse effect heats Earth by about 30 Celsius. That's really important. Without the atmosphere, you think it's cold today, it'll be cold like Antarctica if we didn't have the atmosphere. So a little bit of greenhouse effect is very, it's vital, actually, but it's very fine-tuned. So anyway, with Venus, the water changed from liquid water, which absorbs carbon, to steam, which is a greenhouse gas. The visible light passes through, heats up the surface radiates infrared light, which doesn't get through, gets reflected back, and gets hotter and hotter and hotter. So the water accelerates the heating, and more water evaporates, and then poof, the liquid water is gone in the form of steam. Some of it rises to the top of the atmosphere. The sun's ultraviolet light and the solar wind both hit the atmosphere, break apart the hydrogen, and off it goes. Venus lost its hydrogen, Venus lost its water, and all that carbon stayed in the atmosphere with the oxygen. We have the same amount of carbon here, it's just locked in the rocks.
But how is that made it so thin?
The atmosphere?
Yeah.
Well, we have the same stuff. We have the same carbon and oxygen. It's locked up in rocks. If you were to take Earth rocks, if you were to, say, boil away the oceans or take away the oceans and then allow Earth rocks to liberate their carbon and oxygen, we'd have the same amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere as Venus does.
So how do you explain the fact that
Volcanism. It's got volcanoes. Actually, it has active volcanoes now. There's a little probe, and it's a little probe that could called Akatsuki. It's a Japanese probe. They tried to orbit Venus 5 years ago, and there was a little meltdown in the rocket nozzle. And so it got to Venus, and it couldn't slow down. And it went right by, and they went, oh, no, in Japanese. And now, luckily, the spacecraft has a bunch of little rockets for attitude control and positioning. And those were powerful enough, just powerful enough, so that it swung by a couple of times, and then 5 years later, they were able, after some mid-course corrections, they were able to get into orbit with just their positioning thrusters, and now it's in a giant orbit around Venus. And it's there to look for lightning, which we think is caused by dust and ash in the atmosphere ejected by volcanoes, the rubbing together, hot spots on volcanoes, and then sulfur dioxide, which changes. The sulfur dioxide in Venus fluctuates, and that's ejected by volcanoes. Venus probably has active volcanoes right now. So it's just the geology of the planet. But it's a big potato. So the planets stay hot, the bigger they are.
Well, with Earth, the reason why we have plate tectonics is because of the water.
Well, no. It's hot.
The surface... I understand that, but without the water, you don't have... like with the subduction zone, that water down in there acts as a flux.
That I don't know. The layer of water is pretty thin. Water can do things like change.
There's water in the
That's true. There is water down the below the ocean floors. There's some water. That is getting to the edge of my knowledge of the. That's more of a geology thing. There's a guy named Keith Mountain here who should talk about that.
I just found it interesting that Venus, which has no water, has volcanoes.
It does. Well, it has a hot interior. It's a hot interior. Our interior is hot because of radioactive decay. And the other thing that keeps us hot is we're big. If you stick in a big potato and a little potato in the oven and take them out, the big potato will keep its heat. So Mars and Mercury, Mars doesn't have very much volcanism. It hasn't, its volcanoes haven't erupted for several millions of years at least. Mercury, maybe a couple of billion years ago, but not recently. Venus and Earth are bigger. They kept their heat. They're called the heat of formation, and they probably have, Earth has radioactive elements in it in the middle, which keep it hot. Probably Venus does too. And so if you have the liquid interior, it'll come out. The role of the oceans, you know what? I'll look this up. If you email me.
I think when Magellan first mapped Venus, there was a theory going around saying that the surface had been resurfaced.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was about 500 million years ago.
But I don't think that it ever.
It might have been a giant impact. At this point, I know that there are people looking for rides, so I would like to say thank you for coming. I'm happy to take individual questions down here, but thank you very much for coming, and please be generous. Are there any astronomy students or former astronomy students here? Future astronomy students? Okay, the astronomy students are helped with research funding because basically when they work in the summer on a project, it's a choice of that or McDonald's or third shift UPS. It is. And if they want to do research with a faculty member, that's how we pay them. If we want to get time on a telescope, the government telescopes are pretty much gone. We got to pay for telescope time. We got to buy time from the rich guys like Caltech and Berkeley and MIT. So astronomy is a rich sport. Please help us to spread the word and educate our students.